Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
You're listening to the Times Red Box podcast. Nobody respects it more than me. So beautiful. Beautiful people. Beautiful views.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast on the Times. I'm Matt Chorley. There is nothing of interest happening in Westminster at the moment, apart from the sex and the resignations and the secret meetings and Boris being Boris. So forgetting all that, we're going to look across the Atlantic. It is exactly a year since conventional politics was proved wrong all over again, this time by voters in America. Joining me to cast a critical eye over what's happened in the year since we woke up to President Trump, our Times columnist Jenny Russell, who argues Trump is not interested in helping anyone but himself. Sir Christopher Mayer, former British ambassador to the US from 1997 to 2003. He says we should finally now stop talking about the special relationship. And impressionist Rory Bremner on whether it's possible to satirise the most extraordinary character to inhabit the Oval Office. Before we begin, a quick thank you to everyone who's posted reviews on iTunes recently, to Andrew in Dubai, Amit in Leeds, Justin Bieber of Brent, Alison Barter and Casper 3142. Good luck with the A-levels, Kieran Webb. Sorry about all the dog-walking adverts. And a special mention to Marketing Oliver, who says this is a good podcast. You should subscribe and even occasionally listen to it. Let's hope this is one of those occasions. To those of you who have complained about me banning Brexit, don't worry, there's a Brexit special coming next week. Send your questions to redbox@thetimes.co.uk. For those of you who liked me banning Brexit, don't worry, you can just skip that episode. Right then, down to today's business. Let's turn the clock back and remember what happened exactly a year ago. And this is how we covered it on the Red Box podcast. Hello and welcome to this special Red Box podcast from the Times, broadcast live on Facebook. I'm Matt Chorley. It's Wednesday, October the 9th, 2016, the day the world awoke to the news that Donald Trump has been elected President of the United States of America. Barack Obama has congratulated him, invited the White House on Thursday. President Putin said he hopes to take US relations out of their critical condition. Here in Britain, Theresa May has congratulated Trump, saying she was looking forward to working with him to ensure the security and prosperity of our nations in the years ahead. Jeremy Corbyn said Trump's victory was a rejection of a failed economic consensus. The Archbishop of Canterbury is now praying for the American people, with the hope that Mr. Trump may be given wisdom, insight and grace. Celebrities, including singer Katy Perry, is threatening a revolution. And Adria Leadsom, and I'm honestly not making this up, greeted the news this morning with a tweet saying, "New stats on bathing water quality show our favourite swimming spots are the best on record." So that's at least something we can be glad of this morning.
So, Rory, it's fair to say it's been quite a year.
God, that brought back the memories. I remember this time last year, exactly, switching on the television, and there was a strange man with the weird hair, surrounded by his family, his children, making his acceptance speech, and a choir in the background singing, "You can't always get what you want." And I thought, my God, John Lewis had done a good Christmas advert this year. And it's true. And ever since, you know, I do feel, looking back, for months, I just thought this is just some really bad mistaken identity movie. And I would keep rewinding it, you know, to get to a happy ending. But it sort of goes on and on. I mean, I kind of feel it's like Trump is a bit of a box set. There were three box sets, Trump, Brexit and Corbyn. And I don't want to watch the whole thing. I just want to know how it ends. Because Melania, of course, she says she wants him to be the next Kennedy. So maybe she's thinking about a happy ending too. Too soon? I don't know.
Right, let's get down to business with Jenny Russell and what motivates the US president.
Trump's a much better strategist than we give him credit for. His administration looks a mess because he doesn't understand how government works and he doesn't care. He's not wondering how can I be a good president, he's wondering how can the presidency be good for me.
So Jenny, this is an interesting question. Is he a guy who just got lucky or is he a brilliant political genius? You seem to be coming down on the latter.
Well, he's brilliant political genius in his own terms. I think the mistake that we make is that we keep on judging him on ours. He gets into office and we think, is he going to keep his promises and can he deliver on the economics and why can't he get Congress behind him? And Trump doesn't care about that. He got into power because he knew how to play his audiences. He'd practiced that being a reality TV star and he knew how to, as he put it, suck all the oxygen out of the media coverage. And he appealed to a base who felt that they hadn't been heard for many years, and they were dismissed and ignored. He said to them, I respect you, I admire you, I'm a self-made man, and look at me, and I'm reflecting back to you what you could be, and we're all outsiders together. And once in office, he's gone on with exactly the same priorities that he had all his life, which is, how can I get richer? How can I become more famous? And how do I keep my support? And he's keeping his support brilliantly, because he's appealing to all the cultural ideas that he put in front of his base. Basically, you're being left behind, I'm on your side, I'm going to make your lives better again.
And to what extent do you think it began with him just saying what he thought, which luckily for him chimed with part of the electorate in America, or did he change what he was saying to try and win over that support? Was it just that he ended up inadvertently being the man who caught the public mood?
It probably was inadvertent, because I'm sure he didn't do any focus groups. But the thing is, Trump is, you know, a disgruntled man who feels he's been not respected sufficiently by the world. He's been left outside by the New York society, whose admiration he's always craved. He feels like the uncultured guy from the Bronx. He resents the elites. He thinks that no one's respected him sufficiently. He's clearly got, at the very least, strong white nationalist tendencies. And he thinks the world has been unfair to America and that good white American men like himself ought to be seen as a great deal more important than they are. And that resonates.
He did sort of rather say it himself the other day, didn't he? Because they were saying there aren't enough nominees for the new positions in the State Department. And he said, you know, I've got to say the only one that matters is me. I'm the only one that matters.
That sums up his presidency.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's almost like Louis XIV. Isn't it? L'état, c'est moi. I don't speak French, but I speak Slovenian.
And that's exactly what's so curious about watching what's going on there, that so clearly this is a Tudor court. And people are basically waiting around nervously, afraid of speaking out of line in case they get their heads chopped off. And all power emanates from one man, and he can change his mind in an instant.
Christopher.
I entirely agree with Jenny that he's operating on a political template that bears no resemblance to the one that we've been used to ever since the Second World War. However, the interesting thing in all of this is, if perchance Bob Mueller, the special prosecutor, starts to get really close to him on the Russia connection, and Trump does what Nixon did in 73 and fires Mueller as Nixon fired Archibald Cox. The interesting thing is that back then, the checks and balances came into play. Good, solid Republican senators stood up and said, we won't put up with this. And in the end, it became either impeachment or retirement. And as we know, Nixon went into retirement. What I think is really interesting about the Trump phenomenon is, although he's been operating wholly outside the traditional political framework, come the day that he fires Mueller, the checks and balances will no longer be there, because he has so intimidated the Republican Party, or, from a Republican point of view, presents the only way to get the tax cuts that they crave and the dismantling of the whole Obama administration. And that it'll, you know, a curious, great curve will return to traditional politics and destroy it.
Really? It's like normal rules don't apply. I mean, normally when people resign or people are in trouble, they say, I take responsibility. But here's a man who doesn't really understand the concept of taking responsibility. But extraordinarily, if you are that person who has no concept of taking responsibility, it's extraordinarily liberating because you can do what you like and you can bend the truth, you can bend accountability. All the time is extraordinary. So it makes it slightly difficult to get a handle on him. And maybe that's part of the problem.
And that's why all our forecasts and predictions have turned out to be wrong, because we've forever said it cannot be possible that he can survive that, or it can't be possible that he will achieve that. That is because we are not thinking in the Trump universe. I actually think he probably does understand responsibility, but he doesn't care.
And once you cross that threshold, it's a bit like, in a smaller way, we saw it with Jeremy Corbyn in this country. Once he didn't care that half of his shadow cabinet resigned, under normal rules, one person resigning is enough. But once you refuse to obey that rule, it doesn't matter. As many as you can end up with so many people resigning, you can't fill all the jobs, and it doesn't matter. You just got to carry on.
He does care about it if you're rude about him.
Yes.
Or you take a crack at him, and then you get the sort of Twitter diarrhea.
Yes, we see. I think that's the chink in his armour, as it were, is the vanity, the huge vanity. And I think maybe one of the ways to sort of come back at him is to use that vanity against him. So he starts to boast about himself. You know, I want to say straight away, I've got the lowest approval rating of any president. It's now 37%, 59% disapprove. That's a net negative of 22. I don't think even Truman got close. I think he was negative, but not that well. We had the fastest resignation in American history, Mike Flynn. I think it was about 24 days. And we've seen 14 people go, these are records, Matt. These are records. And records count. So this is the only language, in a sense, he understands. Just as apparently they give him briefing documents which mention his name as many times as possible, because the only way you can keep his attention to what he's reading is by putting himself in it. So I think if the criticism is directed very much at him, well, where else would you direct it? I think eventually it will find a way through, because he has a very thin skin.
And presumably your point, Christopher, about Republicans sticking by his side, they will only do that up until the point they think that he might be affecting their own election chances.
That is where conventional politics may click in again. We just don't know, because when the midterm prospects start giving some really seriously reliable polling, and if the polling is horrible for those who are up for re-election in the autumn of next year, then I think you may see a bit of an earthquake in the Republican Party. But until then, he's the best means of getting the tax cuts and the dismantling of the Obama state.
Jenny?
I think the truly petrifying thing about the whole Trump phenomenon is discovering that there is no moral fibre in the Republican Party. I grew up in an era when you thought that even if you disagreed with Republicans, then they had a deep moral sense, and you might disagree with some of their fundamental ideas if you lent, as I would have done, Democrat, but that they had a coherent moral universe. And now it turns out, as long as we get richer, we don't really, and as long as a little subsection of the population who support us get richer, we really don't care what else we do. And it's been watching people absolutely refusing to stand up to Trump in any way, which has been made much easier for these Republicans by the fact that the American political system has been so gerrymandered that most Republicans only have to worry about how does their base regard them? Because the constituency boundaries have been drawn so tightly that they don't have to worry about what's good for the population. They just have to worry about, will the hardliners and the base of the Republicans support me?
There was a sort of Republican tradition, there has been, wasn't it, of appointing slightly maverick, rather strange, eccentric people like Reagan, of course, Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. And I suppose they tried to get Mitt Romney in, but he's Mormon, so they were one letter out. so that didn't work. But, you know, Trump, he just takes it to another level, doesn't he?
And one of the things that struck me, looking as well as looking at his approval ratings, but there was some polling, I think, in the Washington Post and ABC, who looked at if the election was rerun now, Trump wins again. Partly, I think, it's probably Hillary Clinton's sort of woe is me tour hasn't endeared herself to anyone.
It's made it worse for her.
But also, the Democrats don't appear to have got their act up against. I mean, they've got quite a lot to go at, but they don't appear to have got their act together.
It's really striking that only 6% of Trump voters regret their vote. And I think the reason for that is that he appeals to people on an emotional basis. He makes them feel great about themselves. His supporters feel proud to be who they are. Now, against that, if you're the Democrats and you're coming in with a few feeble announcements about how you're going to raise wages slightly, but you're still harping on about how you're going to close down all the coal mines, that just doesn't cut it. You're not playing on the same playing field, and you're not appealing to people in the same way. Until the Democrats come up with some message that says to people, we care about who you are, not just about what might be in your pay packet, I think they're going to go on losing.
I think rather like Trump, I don't think the base, I don't think they care. I really don't think they care. And no matter what Trump says, we're almost in this era, which is extraordinary, that I think they don't care whether he's lying all the time or whatever. And it's almost in an age where we prefer the colourful and extravagant lie to the rather boring and elitist truth that you might think was attached to Hillary Clinton.
I think the answer to, and again, Jenny's put her finger right on the spot there, the answer to the Democratic Party's dilemma. Trump should be an easy target for Democrats. But for some reason or other, and it's not just Hillary Clinton, it eludes them at the moment. Come the day when they find the messenger for the kind of message that you have just described, I think Trump is toast. Because we talk about the base being immovable. It is an immovable base, but it's actually quite a small base. And the key to Trump's victory was, A, the weirdness of the Electoral College, which means he didn't win the popular vote, but he became president, plus the fact that there were a number of people, hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions, I don't know, I haven't counted, who latched on to the hardcore angries who are immovably pro-Trump. And they're the people who could be peeled away.
And they're the ones that, in all elections, that, you know, it's the people who could be persuaded one way or the other who should be going at.
The Bernie Sanders people ought to be peelable, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, we've got to find a candidate who can do that.
But there's not a Republican. I mean, there's, I suppose, McCain has tried, and Flack and some of these other senators, but that's Steve Bannon's job now, isn't it, is to shut them down.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, of course, it's typical that two of them are about to retire from the Senate, so they don't give a shit one way or the other, and poor old John McCain is probably dying. But there is no live senator with a prospect of re-election who has actually stood up and said the same things as Corker and Flake and McCain.
Well, let's move on then and examine what, as we have to in an entirely self-centred British way, what does this all mean for us? This is Christopher May.
The special relationship is a British mirage. The Trump presidency gives us an opportunity to expunge from the UK-US diplomatic lexicon a phrase that neither reflects reality nor serves the British interest.
The only time I've heard the special relationship mentioned in Washington, D.C., on the two occasions when I was posted there, it was used as a stick with which to beat my head, in the sense that if you don't agree with us on this, you don't care about the special relationship. I can't do your accent. You don't care about the special relationship.
That's a pretty good start.
Or the special relationship is going to suffer. We'll make sure it suffers unless you give in to our position. And I once went to see Colin Powell to talk about the first visit to Washington of Jack Straw.
Such a name dropper.
I'm enjoying memory.
What do you mean, Jack
Keep
Straw?
Keep going.
Jack Straw. Yes, yes. But Jack Straw, blessed memory. And Powell showed me his little speech of welcome. And you know, it was the usual anodyne stuff. And somebody had scrawled on the big black felt-tip pen on the top of the page, don't forget the special relationship. And I said to Colin, I said, why has that been written there? And he says, well, we know you Brits will go ape shit if I don't mention the special relationship. And it's such a toe-curling, humiliating moment. It's like Gordon Brown's smile when Obama finally said special relationship.
Maybe you misread the punctuation. It actually said don't, full stop. Forget the special relationship.
Yes. That would have been better in some ways, you know.
So you would say, even in your time, it was only really something that could be just almost a term that could be used.
Well, I mean, I don't want to say that we don't have a close relationship with the United States, all kinds of areas where we have a very intimate relationship. But the notion of a special relationship, which ignores the rules of international relationships, the only nation that has that with the United States is Israel, because Israel has the capacity to influence domestic politics of the United States. Nobody else does, except the Irish from time to time, for weird reasons, historical reasons. And so I wanted to get it out of young diplomats' minds that they could walk into a Washington office and say, here I am, the physical embodiment of the special relationship, and you will give me the following things in this trade negotiation, blah, 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 blah. That kind of thing is just doesn't work.
So what you're arguing is that basically just the use of it obscured some horrible realities. But the realities don't have to be horrible. What was the point? No, but in this case, you know, we were not special, and America didn't think we were special, and as you've just made clear, we were never going to get any special treatment. But what was the point of the phrase? To whom was it meant to appeal then? The British public?
The media have a lot to answer for, yeah.
Yes. Well, they often
do.
It's very rare. I'm sorry to make a heretical point.
We don't feel responsible for the whole of the media, Matt and me.
No. But I mean, the thing is, if ever there was the tiniest burp in the British-American relationship, there was something not quite right. Immediately, a newspaper, I mentioned nobody in particular, would have a headline, "Wither the Special Relationship." Now, is this the end of civilization as we know it? And is the relationship going to go? And part of the problem is that in public and through the media, our benchmark for the health of the relationship has been whether it is special or not. And that is the wrong benchmark. If you look historically at moments of special, you could possibly say Macmillan and JFK, you know, say Blair and Clinton. Mm. You could say
Blair and Bush.
Thatcher and Reagan. Blair and Bush, but it worked precisely in the reverse way, which I was talking about.
We had to do what they wanted under Blair and Bush.
Yes, I think that was the irony of the whole thing, because I think Tony Blair felt that he could be, just as Clinton was sort of slightly advising the young Tony Blair, I think he felt that he could sort of exert influence on Bush, and he would be the bridge between America and Europe, and he was, in the sense that George Bush walked all over him.
That was a double delusion, that the Europeans would accept Tony Blair as the bridge, and secondly, that George Bush would accept mentoring from Tony Blair.
Do you think, Christopher, that this message has got through to young diplomats now? Do they have a very important clear-sightedness now about their relationship
with
America?
Well, I'm so old now, I don't have much contact with young diplomats. Well,
no one comes to you for wise advice?
But they are realistic. The people who are not realistic are the politicians.
Well, I was going to say that. Did you find you were trying to persuade Tony Blair and other people in his administration that there was no such thing as a special relationship?
I never said that, because it was like farting in church. I couldn't do that. I simply couldn't do that. But what I did say from time to time was, look, this is one-way traffic. You know, we've just sent the Royal Marines to Afghanistan, and they've now slapped tariffs on imports of certain types of British steel. This is not right.
There have been two sort of quite big blows recently in the last sort of 18 months or so, I suppose. One was Obama, when Obama annoyed the Brexit part of Britain by saying, you know, you're going to go to the back of the queue. That was one. And so I think that really annoyed the Brexiteers. And for the Remainers, of course, the Bombardier deal is now, that for the other side, if you like, the other side of the Brexit divide, the news that they're going to slap 200% tariffs on goods, That's right. The end of that special relationship.
That's right.
Do you think the politicians now are still deluded, Christopher? Do you think May doesn't understand how brutally she's like to be treated by Trump?
What did you make of Theresa May rushing over to the White House and holding
his principle,
hand?
In principle, actually, I'd had no objection to it at all. It all depended on what message she gave him. Hmm. And if she said to him, you bloody well better, you know, subscribe to Article 5 of the NATO Treaty and give up your protectionism. And there was other stuff that she threw into the pot as well. I didn't have a problem with that. And the hand-holding, I never thought was hand-holding. I thought genuinely Donald Trump has a problem with slopes. I was told there's an elaborate Greek word for this.
Yes, there is. There's a fear of steps.
Fear of slopes and steps. And I think he has that. And you see it with Melania. And they're coming down the steps. I think actually she's trying to push him down.
I just held her hand to stop it from running away. So that's what that is.
So I didn't have a problem in principle with that. But if anyone thinks that negotiating a trade agreement with the Americans is going to be easy...
Well, that's the other thing, is that in the current climate, you know, the status or the state of our relationship with America isn't just... you know, the quality of the gifts that Gordon Brown exchanges with Barack Obama on a visit. It depends, you know, it's going to decide the state of our economy, Jenny. And there's an awful lot of Brexiteers who are still of the mindset that Christopher worries about.
Well, they ought to listen to, first of all, Trump's record, which is always find out the other guy's weaknesses and then ruthlessly exploit them. And he's make America great again, and America's going to come first, not us. Secondly, his trade secretary the other day said that Britain had better be jolly careful, because basically the terms of any trade agreement with the US must be that Britain must go with American rules, i.e. admitting chlorinated chicken, and yes. not European ones, which say that you have to have a much more hygienic system from top to bottom.
We used to call it coronation chicken, didn't we? Now we call it coronation
That's
chicken.
That's a great phrase. Yeah. Back well, to Michael, the 50s in many ways.
Michael Gove has already ruled out coronated chicken, I think. Anyway.
we'll have no trade deal with the United States.
Well, this is the thing.
Do we need one?
Well, this is the thing. Liam Fox has been over there, but completely unprepared. I think we sent something like 77 people. It may even have been 27. I think it was 77 people over in our delegation and found hundreds of American trade negotiators on the other side of the table who thought, you know, where are the others?
Yes. Well, we were lucky we had 77 because wasn't it right that only one actually had trade experience?
One of them's never done it before. The rest of us sort of apprenticeships.
It's not rocket science. It's not rocket science. Negotiating trade deals are not rocket science. It's not as if you have
that's
to,
North Korea.
Well, we could hire some North Korean trade negotiators, but I mean, you know, it's not that difficult, but there's the connecting rod between the president making encouraging noises about a trade deal and actually sitting on the other side of the table from 777 American trade negotiators who are actually by profession litigation lawyers, and they're going to grab you by the whatnots and squeeze as hard as they can, and you just got to go back and squeeze them back, and in the end we'll get a deal. But do we need one?
But
they're our largest export market, and we have a trade.
So many mental images.
World out there,
so many mental images. Just before we move on, Donald Trump's state visit, not quite state visit, what a state visit. Do we think that's imminent? Should it be? Do we just get it over and done with, Jenny?
Well, I'm hoping there are going to be mass demonstrations and that he is, as Rory says, going to be absolutely mortified by discovering quite how unpopular he is. Because, you know, the one thing about him is that he wants to be admired, respected and loved. Here he isn't.
I think he should come over, but we should take the piss. So, you know, Air Force One will arrive, we make him stack over Stansted for 2 hours.
Make him land at
Gatwick, and then he can get on a train, Southern Rail, so that'll stop at every state. Get to East Croydon, a replacement bus service. By the time he gets to London, there's a tube strike. He'll have to walk to Buckingham Palace, where the Queen will greet him, as Ross Noble said, in a burqa. You know, that would be great. I want to see Hadrian's Wall, by the way. He was a great, wonderful man. I knew him very well. And you don't get many Mexicans in Scotland, Matt, let me tell you.
Christopher, state visits, are they a nightmare for...
Yeah, I mean, the last time he had a highly demonstrated state visit by an American president was George W. Bush, and was it 2003, just after the start of the Iraq War, and the whole of London had to be shut down virtually. But George W. had a different kind of temperament. He knew... He may have many weaknesses, but he's not a narcissist. And he knew the demonstrations were coming, and he just brushed them off. I think we should not have a state visit, because I think there will be serious demonstrations. And we actually do have some hard interests in the relationship with the United States. And if Trump is humiliated very, very publicly, we'll never hear the end of it. We'll be enemy number one.
Can his visit be postponed altogether, do you think?
Yeah, there's a rumor that the new American embassy down in Nine Elms is going to be officially opened early next year. And there's some kind of weird rumour that you're going to come over and do it.
For a non-state visit, just a quick token
you
visit
can come
to
over
Britain
for a working,
without demonstrations.
Working visit.
So long as he stays south of the river.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, let's move on then to our final talking point, because Rory, you want to talk about whether or not you can hurt him through satire.
In a post-truth age, Trump is almost post-satire. Normal rules don't apply, as he's more than capable of satirizing himself. In playing him as a fool and a clown, there's a danger that we give him a license to operate beyond normal accountability. And this is somebody who, early in his presidency, he said, "We've now seen the most successful 13 weeks in the history of the United States presidency." He'd been president for 11 weeks at that point. And, you know, where do you start? People always say, "Oh, you couldn't make it up." He does. He makes it up all the time.
Yeah. It was Tom Lehrer, the brilliant satirist, who said that back in 1974, I think, that satire was obsolete when they gave the Nobel Peace Prize to Henry Kissinger. And now we're in that era. We had Tony Blair as Middle East Peace Envoy, you know, a job he gave up last year, didn't he, Christopher? Oh, yeah. Mission accomplished. I don't think the Middle East has ever been more peaceful. But, yeah, there you go. Lovely to see you, Christopher, by the way. Great job. So well, we've got that, and we have Boris. This is, you can't make this stuff up. This week, he said, 3 days ago, he said, no, a joke. A joke is a very good way of getting your diplomatic point across, which presumably is why Theresa May appointed him in the first place. And the third of those trilogies, you've got Donald Trump. And, you know, where do you go with a character who's beyond parody? You know, I think we have to find new ways of getting through to him. That's I sometimes call it, you know, fighting fire with facts. And so if you keep hitting him with actually the reality of his approval rating and all the other things. But if we play in too much to this idea that he is a fool and he is a clown, it's rather like the Boris thing, where you give him the space to operate and be like, it's what you come to expect of Donald Trump.
The sort of Boris is Boris argument.
Exactly, that Boris is Boris, which allows Boris to get away with all sorts of stuff. And in the case of Trump, you know, if it's Trump, is Trump. But it's on a bigger scale.
Jenny?
Much as I admire most of what Rory says, I'm afraid that I think he's quite wrong to think that one ought to use the kinds of weapons that Christopher and I might use against Trump, which is facts. I think we should use what Rory is so brilliant at, which is satire and mockery, because that's clearly the only thing that hurts. He brushes off facts. He just states that things are not as they are, and they're completely irrelevant to him, nor do his base seem to mind. The one thing that he does mind, and we know this from his reaction to the way he's portrayed on all those American satirical shows like Saturday Night Live, is that he can't stand it when people laugh at him, and that is the best weapon we've got against him.
Mm-hmm. But I suppose it's what you load the weapon with. That's the thing. If you're firing his failures back at him with a satirical and a comedy bow attached, that was my thing.
With Saturday Night Live before the election, they lampooned him every week. You know, it made Alec Baldwin, you know, a bigger star than he even was for any film he'd been in. And there was a sort of slight disbelief the week after the election on Saturday Night Live that hadn't worked. Him up enough.
We were back to what Peter Cook. We were back to what Peter Cook said about satire doing so much in the 1930s to prevent the rise of Adolf Hitler. But you know, also, you're into that territory again, and it just doesn't do the job.
And his base, of course, just hates that. I mean, it bolsters his support because they say, "Look, here's the liberal elite just mocking us." So, I mean, what I've just said, I now totally contradict. It might make Trump very cross, but it also makes his base cross. And actually, what you want to do in America is to find some way of making those people feel not attacked by the Democrats and feel able to shift some of their loyalties and identities. Because in the end, Trump is going to damage those people. He may be good for making them feel great, but he's not going to deliver economically. Their lives are going to get worse.
There's a psychological side to this which is quite interesting. And that's firstly, it's difficult for Americans. There's a law, the Goldwater Rule, that you'll be aware of, I'm sure. It's one of the laws of the American Psychiatrists Association. You're not able to publicly diagnose somebody. And this goes back to when Goldwater, they asked thousands of American, 1,200 American psychiatrists what their opinion was of Goldwater. And they got thousands of replies, and half of them said he was unfit for office. And so they printed that in this magazine, now defunct, called Fact. And he objected, Goldwater, he objected to being called unfit for office. He said, well, they haven't diagnosed me, they haven't examined me personally. And he won the case. So ever since, out there are thousands and thousands of American psychiatrists and psychoanalysts and psychologists who say, do we really need to examine him personally? Because quite clearly, this thing about narcissistic personality disorder But so there is, I mean, you look at him and as a layman, you can see the narcissistic personality disorder, you can see the Machiavellian thing, you can see the sociopath, and I can recognise a certain amount of attention deficit. So there's the four strawberries of the apocalypse right there on that machine. But the other thing that fascinates me is, have you come across the Dunning-Kruger effect? The Dunning-Kruger, this is a Cornell psychologist called Dunning and his research assistant. And they did research into stupidity and this idea that stupid people don't realise they're stupid. Because in order to know that you're stupid, you have to have a certain degree of intelligence. And their way of doing this, they set an exam for groups of people in something that they didn't know anything about. So people had to write about something they didn't know anything about. And afterwards, he said, "Well, how did that go?" And of course, the brighter people said, "Well, I think that was really bad because I don't know very much about it." And the stupid people, who in this case are characterised as Donald Trump, said, "I think I did very well. I think I got 9 out of 10, and that's how it goes." So I think there's an element of that. He lacks self awareness. But then, of course, as I said before, if you lack self-awareness, then...
You're not aware of it. That's the...
you're not aware of it.
Christopher, do you think satire works, or can it work on somebody like Donald Trump?
Yeah, I think satire works in this sense. I think the one thing that Trump cannot take, and I think this is a function of his narcissism, is pressure. He actually is not good at taking pressure. Now, he has all kinds of mechanisms to avoid having to be pressurised. When things don't go his way... He apparently, I mean, more and more of this stuff comes out through leakers in the White House. He goes apeshit and lashes out. And it's so obvious that Twitter is a safety valve for him. It's intense frustration that, things, he cannot get people to say what he thinks is right and do what he thinks is right. And the more I think he gets frustrated by the inability, even with a Republican majority in both houses, to get his legislative program through. I mean, nothing's gone, nothing. The drip, drip, drip of mockery adds to that pressure. So I think Rory should cross the Atlantic
with that.
You could occupy Steve Bannon's office.
I'd love to do that, let me tell you, Christopher. But just to pick up something that you said, I mean, just the way in which he runs the presidency, it is extraordinarily dysfunctional, because if he just attaches it all to himself, it's all about himself. There are, I think I'm right in saying, half the ambassadors haven't been appointed, and those who have no proper instructions. And right across government, all the way across the American administration, they're scratching their heads wondering what to do, because the normal channels of instruction and policy and strategy, he doesn't have any time for it because he's got no concept.
But I think there is method in this madness, and it comes from Steve Bannon, who has this idea that you have to smash everything and build it up again in the way that you would want it to be. They obviously think in the alt-right, and Trump himself, that the State Department is totally useless. Which is why Rex Tillerson gets a little support from the White House. But the deliberate deconstructing of the state, the polity, the foreign policy, it's not just carelessness and lack of attention to detail and narcissism and lunacy and whatever else. I think there is actually, and the lying, there is actually some deliberation there. There is a sort of plan, which is out of all this chaos comes the kind of presidency that he, Trump, wants to have and the kind of president that he wants to be.
Well, just before we wind up, we talked about this in one of the comedy specials we did earlier in the year, but do you like doing impressions of Donald Trump? Is he a good person to do?
Well, in the sense that he's, I think any impressionist, you love to find a new target. You like to have the new voice, as it were. And it is... But all the reasons we've talked about, it's interesting trying to... It's a new challenge. Mm. And with each character that comes up, I mean, you use the different kind of satire with Tony Blair than you did with John Major. The tools that you use and the tools that you have to sort of find and discover change with each prime minister and president. So in that sense, it's an enjoyable challenge. But I think, politically, for the reasons that Christopher's just outlined, I think there's something very worrying underneath it. And I think... the way that I always try to operate is to make sense of what's happening and then make nonsense of it. Obviously, when you're starting with nonsense for a start, but I think underlying it is something really very difficult and challenging and unsettling and
very disturbing.
That's the biggest worry.
I mean, we come to a pretty pass when whoever translates into English what Kim Jong Un says has a better command of the English language than the President of the United States.
And where the sanest person in the administration is a man called Mad Dog Mattis.
Right, well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes on your Android device and sign up to my morning email at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. And if you've got any questions about Brexit you want us to answer next week, just email us redbox@thetimes.co.uk. If you want to see Rory performing live with a couple of live shows this month with Jan Ravens, then go to rorybremner.net. But for now, from Rory Bremner, Christopher Mayer, Jenny Russell and me, Matt Cholley, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.